No, we are going to. Would we do it in German or in English? How should we proceed? Switch? English. Okay. So there is still simultaneous translation for everybody. The day started with three presentations on critical. This is the opportunity to open the floor, of course, but I just wanted to make an initial question and then we go on. The day started with a reflection on three critical practices from the past, Großstadtpädagogik, the experiences in Great Britain, and finally the experience of the citizen school project. And while I was following the presentation, I thought if there is a link between this situation of emergency of and the possibility to develop a politics of hope. So I would like to come back to this politics of hope, because I think the way we interpret it and the way we re-articulate it depends very much on the assumption which is the departure point. And I would like to ask Carmen, which is the departure point in German society she's describing when mentioning what can get wrong in these collaborations. And I would also like Arjun to describe the point of departure of these approaches. Yeah, please.
Well, I hello? Is this working?
No, it's just a matter of time.
It's a matter of time.
Okay, take magic. Or magic.
I hope that I understood your question right, because I really had like acoustic problems in the beginning. But I will just start to talk and then you can interrupt me if you think that I didn't grasp the question. Yeah. So that was something which I was really concerned about when I wrote the comment, you know, that I think this concept is so locally specific and has to be translated in each context. Very, you know, with all its particularities. And when I was thinking about it in our context here, it worried me that in all the reflections which we have been doing here in the conference, and I think also in the collaborations which you have in the framework of Schools of Tomorrow, we are actually not tackling the spheres of this of the educational sector in the city or in the country, which could be compared to something like a concept of subalternity. Yeah, it's just not included. It's something like the suppressed dimension. When we talk about schools of tomorrow, we don't think about these places where you have accumulation of everything that goes wrong, you know, which I mean, there are situations just like from what I know from, you know, being 23 years in the systems, which I can only compare to jails, you know, not so much because I think people are incarcerated, but in terms of the dynamics, which evolve in those places. And I think this is exactly where such a concept needs to be located. And, you know, we have to start from there when we talk about the politics of hope. Mm-hmm. Is that an answer to your question or not?
It is.
So much? Thank you. I'm glad it is.
Arjun?
Well, maybe I'll use this. Well, thank you, Sylvia. I'm also thinking that your question could be engaged at different levels of geography or of scale, but let me just dive in and say one thing, first of all, which is that I completely agree with Carmen that the status quo, the current state of affairs, is a huge excessive dominance of a small group. Let's call them white, let's call them male, let's call them older. Although some of us are not white and some of us are male and some of us are older, but still, that group is excessively present in defining what is knowledge, who should get it, what is taste, what is judgment, and so on. So diversifying that, I think, is an aim that we all share. The question becomes the how of that. And so my answer to the question of the departure point or staging point for that, whether we're talking about Berlin, whether we're talking about Germany, whether we're talking about Europe, or whether we're talking in a more broad global scale, is that particularly taking the politics of hope seriously, which was in my mind throughout my talk but not articulated clearly. Again, I would say I fully support Carmen's idea, and I've said this in writing also, that the challenge about aspiration is that it's diverse. Some people want more wealth, some people want more health, some people want more friendship, some, you know, it's culture, and not just some people, but some whole societies are organized around different ideas of a good life. That's both a research problem and a practical problem. You can't assume that everybody wants what I want, so let me help them get to be like me. That is an older model. So we have some challenges there, but I think leaving that aside, the question of how, for example, you bring groups that are suppressed, marginalized, silent, subordinated into this bigger conversation from the point of view, let's say, of research, but you could also ask it about other things, involves a readiness on the part of us, largely educated, relatively privileged people, to eventually disappear. But to disappear, we have to first appear. And the only catch with disappearance. And appear not in our normal guise, but as people who are involved in transferring our methods without requiring the same life we lived, which is, let's say, to go to university for 5 years, go to postgraduate school for another 5 years, do research for another 5 years, write 3 or 4 articles of dubious worth, then do the habilitation when we are nearing retirement, etc. This is, to impose this requirement means immediately exclude 90% of the world. So we have to find more direct methods. And if, and to the extent to which those direct methods succeed, and it doesn't matter whether it's Berlin or Mumbai, I think these are really universal things, we ourselves will become more and more dispensable. And we have to be ready for that. When the moment comes when the person who has learned something about interviews, ethnography, photography, narrative, storytelling, and says, you know, I don't know what you're doing here. I'm fine, you know. I've really figured it out, how to generate effective knowledge, whether of the future or the present, to make it credible, to make it rigorous, and to make it part of an argument, then we have to be ready to retreat. So we have to appear to help, because the training and all won't happen by magic. You can't say, I want you all to become researchers, and psh, it happens. It has to be done in a particular spirit, and then we have to be ready to step back so that research also can be seen as a very diverse kind of activity. Not just the people are diverse, but the practice can also be diverse.
So thanks for that. I think we've been running in the UK a program. We have over 300 projects. We've spent a huge amount of money on it called Connected Communities to try to build collaborations between universities and community partners to build grassroots research. One thing is very clear, you actually need money. So, you know, let's not mess around. Who's in this room? How did we get here? What transport did we use to be able to be here?
What childcare facilities do we have to allow us to be in this room, and so forth. So it's fundamentally you need to address the financial issues that enable people to have the space to think about doing research. However, I would say we've learned a lot about how you do that, and there's lots of evidence out there. But I suppose my question is, when we're thinking about the future, is research enough anymore? So what I would say is we're living in a crisis of research. We have, in the UK, we have government ministers saying we don't want to listen to experts anymore. We've had enough of that. We're living in a climate where evidence is seen as just one truth amongst many. And particularly when we're looking at the field of the future, we have a new breed of consultants, commercial companies, who are selling particular ideas about the future. So we need not only to build the capacity for research, which I completely agree with, but we also need to build the capacity to critically interrogate and challenge the ideas of the future that we are being presented with. And the problem with research is it tells us what's already happened. It tells us what we know. I know it is an inquiry into the not yet known, but once it becomes known, it is known. So you then are not in the field of the future. You have to come at it from a different direction. So we need to build and democratize, in all the critical ways that we're talking about, the capacity not just to aspire, not just to conduct research, but to produce rigorous ways of thinking about the future, contesting the assumptions that are being made about it, contesting the visions that are being put forward, and being able to generate alternative visions. Without that, frankly, we're not actually going to address any of these issues.
Gerd, would you like to comment on this topic?
I can. Maybe a few observations. In terms of where we are in relation to who we are not, I think what I hear is an idea of empowerment. We have something that other people have not, and our duty is to give that to them. The problem I have with empowerment as an educational strategy is that the power that is available is power within a particular field. And if you do empowerment, in a sense, you accept the parameters of the field. That's why I find it valuable just to have two words to make a distinction between empowerment and emancipation. And for me, emancipation always also raises questions about what is actually the field that gives some think power and gives someone power. And for me, that's a different educational dynamic even. And that's why I'm concerned about research. So I would actually say the real issue is about the right to know. And for me, the global research industry is challenging that right by saying, well, only if you have research. It's destroying education by saying, only if you have evidence from large-scale randomized controlled trials, then you are allowed to speak. And that's it. I think it's undermining the teaching profession. It's undermining, I would say, the connection between education and democracy. So I would like to push the discussion just a little bit further into both the question of the right to know, but also that cannot be a question of just empowering, but that right comes with a particular construction of the field in which it has power, and it's partly also pushing that field in a different direction. And there we have a job to do, but I think it's a different job. Also, educationally, it's a different project.
Geht das? Ja, es geht. When I listened to your talk, and I also read the chapter of the book of 2013, I was thinking about all the efforts which have been made since the 1960s under the umbrella term of participatory research, action research. So there is quite a long history of this kind of engagement. And as we, at least here on this side of the table, might all know, it has been going in very different directions. So my concern when I think about the right to know or the right to research, is rather that still we have to have debates on the horizon, you know, because you can do participatory action research for the most repressive and most reactionary means. Yeah, you can teach people to research, you know, I don't have to repeat that, I guess. So, you know, there are some challenges connected to the right to know, the right to research, which are of an ideological nature, I would say, you know, yeah, very like foundational questions.
I would like to open the floor at this point, because I think you may have been writing things down, thinking, oh, I should intervene, I should ask. Other hands raising? Yeah. Here.
Heiner Benking. I'm always daring to be the icebreaker. You see, since 50 years, we discuss mind bugs and mind boggles, when you think you know but don't. And I think it starts not what kind of metaphors we use, but what kind of words. So I would like to question the podium. Have you thought about that the word future is absolutely wrong? Since 45 years with World Future Studies Federation, it's written with S, so it's a plural. And we have to get this into the minds of our people. So this is only one point. I would like to continue later.
Would you like to?
Well, yes, simply we need to pluralize futures. But I mean, it's not just, I mean, future is a hugely problematic word. And we've, I mean, what's been really interesting to me over the last 3 days is hearing the different ways in which we deal with it. So we've got the sort of not yet known, the unknown, the open, that, you know, we've got the, and I think the human capacity to deal with the novelty of what comes next is really where we need to be doing some work. I mean, my concern with the futures field is they have become sort of methodologically obsessed, and, you know, if they can teach you a scenarios exercise, they've done their job. So I think we need to be cautious. I think we need to take some work from them. But my general view is there's actually all sorts of fields that allow us to think creatively around the possible futures we might face. And I think one of the critical things is, how do we combine the commitment to play with theory? So how do we recognize this as an imaginative space, so we're not stuck only in evidence, if you like, but to also at the same time to think about the hard realities, what Ivana Milosevic calls the weight of history. So can we think about the weight of history and the pull of possible futures at the same time? So that kind of play between practical materiality and the imagination at the same time, that to me feels like the beginning of a way in which we might start doing this intelligently.
I'd prefer to read the title of Dewey's book and the title of this conference more literally. I know he meant it as a metaphor for the future, but I actually like the tomorrow, you know. That means tomorrow is Sunday, you're all relaxed, but the day after tomorrow is that tomorrow, so we're starting now.
Other questions, comments?
We didn't manage to wake them up, you know.
Could I ask these guys a question?
Is that
ask
about Bertie okay. First, and then we have to. Yeah.
Well, it was just.
Felix Hoch, I'd be interested in your take on the integration of global planetary worldviews into the schools of tomorrow. Global and planetary worldviews. So it's not just about methodological means. Maybe it is also about worldviews.
Worldviews. It's a good idea.
You know, that's what the great Mahatma Gandhi once said when he was asked, what do you think of Europe? He said, it's a good idea. but he had some follow-up thoughts which I don't think were ever expressed. But I also agree it's a good idea.
Say it's a bad idea?
No. No, no. You see, Gandhi is Gandhi. I mean, he read carefully Hitler. He read carefully Israel's state formation. I mean, there's a Gandhi who was truly ready to read anything and engage with anything. But that's a separate story, though I'll be happy to talk about it in the next conference. But just a few quick things before I say something in relation to these thoughts about my the observations of my colleagues, which I fully agree with. I'm very interested in what you reported about these efforts to generate community-based research. I just don't know about them. And when I began this exercise in the year 2000 or so, there weren't very many that I could find. And since then, I've worked with things like Slum Dwellers International, which have major connections in the multilateral world and this and that. So I'm trying to keep track of that argument or that observation. But I'm always interested in where it's happening, where it's being done, with what effects and results and pluses and minuses. So I'm very interested. But I quickly wanted to say the finance thing is very crucial. And I've just written a tiny consultancy paper for Slum Dwellers International about their strategic planning for the next 10 or 15 years, in which one of the things I say is that direct participation in the financial markets is crucial for these slum communities. Direct participation. That is aggregating community-based savings, which in their case could be up to 20 or 25 or 30 million a year, each year, based on only $4 per year, per family, per member. And there are 14,000 members. So there are numbers here. That's enough to set up a hedge fund. And you can do it directly. You don't have to go to some bank. So I'm a big believer in the fact that we are in a world which has become deeply financialized, which is to say money is made by taking risk on risk. So money makes money, not money that goes into production that then makes money. So it's a long argument, but I'm 100% with you. But I also think it's important to say how the poor who do save and whose numbers are huge can become players in this market. Not say this market is bad people, banks, evil, blah, 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 but get into it. So that's one observation, but I'm with you on that. I also fully agree that the idea of research, which is certainly connected to knowledge, cannot be divorced from its horizons. And the idea that aspiration is diverse also affects my conception of research. And the key thing, which is not participatory research, exactly, it's precisely not that idea, although I think it was a good idea in its day, is that you don't define the problem. I would like these communities to say, this is not the problem. That is the problem. And then do some systematic search. Participatory research is entirely where the knowledge is already, the question is already defined. And you can participate in data gathering. Is that they rarely say,
depends
who is doing it? Oh, sure. But then you will have to convince me that participatory research already is doing this successfully.
Well,
in which case, I'm happy to say, great, we're already there. We don't need tomorrow. We have today.
No, I think there is a big issue. There is a huge problem, which has exactly to do with money and who controls the resources. I would say that there is, like, for example, the tradition of Orlando Falls Borda in Colombia, you know, when you go back. I wasn't between them. I wasn't even born, I think, when they started. But still, I would say from what I perceive, that it was crucial to define questions together with people, or even let people define questions. And I know projects, now back to my expertise in the realm of art education, which are quite radical, but
my impression is, you know, my observation actually is that as soon as those projects are getting really challenging for the existing power structures, people find reasons to quit the funding. It's tragic, but it's true, you know. You can have beautifully, nicely set up participatory action research art education projects.
So you think the ideas are there, the money is not?
Yes. You know? No. There is a lot of stuff going on, but in the moment when these things seem to become dangerous,
support dries up.
Yes. Then support is seized.
Yep.
And I think it shows that these projects are really putting a challenge to existing power structures.
Gert, please, would you comment on
that? Yeah, maybe to pick up a few threads from the questions and the discussion about future and world views. Also because I said I wouldn't talk about Dewey, but here I think there is still something there. There is a clever distinction in Latin between two different notions of the future. I think it is future and fatum or something, which has a bit to do with another thing, but I assume that has been brought up in earlier days, that our relationship to the future can be a colonial one, where we say, well, the future is us. But you can also see the future as something that comes to you, and then you can ask the question, what is actually the task there is, the thing for us to do in what is coming nearer to us. And for me, that is something pragmatist. So when you talk about global worldviews, I think views are important, worldviews are important. But ultimately, it's about what needs to be done. So to have enlarged worldviews can help there, but it can also get in the way from the thing that often is in front of us right here, and we don't see it because we are occupied with something a bit beyond there. That has something to do with, I think, a sound kind of pragmatism to always go back within all the theorizing and analysis to what's actually the problem. And there John Dewey does something really interesting in the book, The Public and Its Problems. There is one sentence I really like where he says, the public has to define itself. And that is a key sort of democratic principle that he says, each time it starts with who defines what the issue is, who defines whose problem is at stake, who defines what needs to be known. That, I think, connects back to the question of research. And then I just slip in quickly. My favorite definition of research is systematic inquiry made public. And systematic inquiry we can all do, but I think there is, particularly in universities, if they are special places, there is always sort of the demand to make that inquiry public, and that means open to public scrutiny, not to publish in some top journal, but open to public scrutiny, but also to hand over to the public. So all these things about copyright and they also undermine the university as a public institution. And I think that's worth fighting for in what is happening with universities as well.
There are some hands raised on this. Yeah, please.
Thank you very much. So this question is not thought through, so I apologize for that in advance. But I'd like to go back to the point of research and the organization that you, Arjun, mentioned. So that feels a bit like entrepreneurship, but I'm not so sure, like social entrepreneurship or something. And like the more I work in the field, I feel like it has a lot of hope, but also it's a very problematic one, because it's almost like teaching someone the art of lying and researching in a way that can give you the outcomes and the results that people would like to hear. Is there something wrong with the voice or with the tone? Okay. So, and it's also almost like teaching someone how to write in a proposal in a way that could get the money in, and also in a way that people want to define the problem by, So it seems like creating a certain narrative or surfing on a certain narrative that is already there in the discourse or something. So I feel like I'm, as someone who's trying to be active in a constructive way, I feel like I'm kind of paralyzed because anywhere I go, whether I try to work in the education system directly or in a startup locally, it's really hard for me to be truly innovative. Of course, I'm supposed to say about myself that I'm innovative, but it does not really feel so innovative because I try to see what's gonna be successful as a research result, you know? So, like, do you have experience with that? Where is the limit in documentation? When do people stop feeling truly active or empowered after they have researched and documented? Thanks.
So thank you very much. This, I'll be very local now to Mumbai. This organization that I started with essentially no money from anywhere. And now we have small philanthropic grants from mainly some philanthropies in India, but also from Rockefeller and Ford Foundation through its Delhi office. So a few reasonable donors, but it's still a very lean organization. It's not big, it doesn't have, I mean, if we had the staff and facilities of HKV, we would have 10,000 fellows a year. Now we have 300, 250 in this youth fellowship, but it's definitely not the social entrepreneurship idea. It is really an idea about how to develop some capacity to make inquiries, to look into the future, and to also analyze the present, which research also does, in order to become citizens with voice in Bombay. So the purpose is not to improve your job or to get you an internship with a multinational company in Bombay, etc. You may get that because you have some more skills, but that's not the aim. The aim is to teach you how to get some more organized knowledge, research-based knowledge, so to speak, without going through the expensive process of becoming a specialist, and so that you can make your arguments more credible. And that goes to the point of the public. The point of this exercise is not so that you may win a Nobel Prize someday or win a Humboldt Fellowship. It is about how, when you go to address the state or address somebody, you can make a more strong case for whatever it is that you want to argue. As a young person, as a poor person, as a working person, as a construction worker, as a Muslim woman, whatever. But where you are slightly more in the space of credible argumentation. Now, there is something that's been running through all our comments. There is no way to change the terms of this engagement without some engagement with where it is now. My politics is one that says there is no straight leap from where we are now, which is embedded in current frameworks, current hegemonies, current power structures, current whatever, in straight into the reality we want. That means we always have to engage with what is and who is, whether it's in finance or in the university or wherever, and then somehow work to interject something. But to go to your basic question, this organization, Mumbai, is definitely not about social entrepreneurship. It's about basic skills, documentation, interviewing, creating small models, writing, and speaking. Very basic things. It's not about making a little businessman. So I can safely say to you that that is not the idea here. It's still very challenging. It's still very difficult because there are people struggling to live in a very hard city. And we can't give them fellowships for years. It's not a postdoc. It's not free time. They're adding this to their capacities.
Kerry, you wanted to add something?
Just quickly, project mentalities do a huge amount of harm. So I would say be very careful. I mean, what we have seen in the shift towards trying to build and support the creation of research capacity in communities is what unfortunately comes with that in our current, particularly in the UK climate, is a project funding-based model. And the project funding-based model can actually really damage some organisations. It pushes them away from their core goals. So the critical issue, I think, is a slightly different one, which is how do we build relationships? How do we build relationships over time that are relationships of dialogue and challenge and solidarity and mutual questioning of what you're trying to do? And that's the sort of thing that we really should be shifting towards. And there are a lot of different sorts of organizations that are setting up outside universities that are getting very good at this. So organizations like the Ecoversities Network, which has alternative universities setting up all around the world, really trying to ask some hard questions about how you build sustained relationships for dialogue, for critique, for questioning, for generating knowledge over time. And I think there's a very interesting question for those of us working in universities is whether universities still remain places that are capable of doing that, given their increasing dependence on project-based funding, which massively impacts on the ability to do long-term thinking and to build relationships in a sustainable way.
Gert, yeah.
I think also to operate in such an environment, you need to have kind of punk mentality to really say F the system from time to time and just go straight somewhere else. The other thing I just wanted to mention is Eric Olin Wright calls this concrete utopias. So it's absolutely true that we sometimes need to make little steps, but sometimes just by showing that something can be done in a different way, we can make a big step. And of course, the biggest problem is that there is so little imagination around how we deal with money. Mm-hmm. But if you think, for example, of the Triodos Bank coming out of Anthroposophy, they have a very different way of looking at what we do with money. Mm-hmm. And they create very different logics that are financially sound, but they create something that's concretely different. So that's interesting too. Not to forget as well and be hopeful about
that. To add in as well, I know just before Carmen comes in, the cooperative movement internationally has 9 billion people involved. It is setting up new economic, different, well, long-standing, 150-year-old models for the economic basis for democratic knowledge production. The other thing is governments and funders can only do things on a project basis if people continue to bid for them. If people collectively refuse to bid for them, they would have to set up new models. So it's worth thinking about how do we resist the marketization of this cultural practice and recognize that it needs to be addressed differently.
Karen.
I just want to add that because often the view or the gaze goes directly into the money question, which is, of course, absolutely crucial. But recently, I become more and more aware that time is just like an equally crucial factor, because the time regimes in which our work is done really support the reproduction of power structures. And I think today it's really a subversive act to delay things, to become slower and to become less productive.
We are going to take we are going to take two final questions there and there.
Yes, thank you for all your contributions in the last few days. What I mentioned is that the word urgency was mentioned a lot. We have a global, local, educational, artational, financial, whatever crisis going on. But you also said, and Carmen mentioned it again, that when we point out to the problems the structure has, the power of the structures takes its control back and allows us not to change. And the experts, as Kerry said, they are no longer heard today anymore. So how can we, as being expert here together, feeling the urgency, have a strategy? What kind of strategy would you suggest for change so that these people who have the power, the majority who doesn't even notice any urgency or doesn't want to change, how can we help them, educate them to start this change?
And the last question. Yeah, I have a. The question is, if we talk about the right to know or the right to aspire, it presupposes will and the desire to aspire. And we know from, I think, the microphysics of repression and of exclusion that that ability, the ability to aspire and to hope and to even imagine what a right to know might mean, is something that is deeply affected by exclusion and by repression. And that seems to be somewhat on a different level or maybe even more existential than the suggestion or the strategy to pluralize. I mean, it's not about pluralizing the personnel or the canon, but it seems to, I mean, we somehow have to tackle on a different level. How do we actually create this imagination and this desire in certain communities and in certain areas where that is exactly what is being taken away from them, you know, by poverty, by repression, by exclusion? Well, please.
Yes, yep. I would like to respond to Karine's question because I think it touches on things that have been on the table in different ways, power, finance. There is different points of entry into what we all sense is the same kind of general problem of exclusion, subordination. So first thing to say is, I have to do a sort of bad academic thing because that's my species, to say that when I wrote this essay on the capacity of spy, it was a direct intervention into the Nancy Fraser, Alex Honneth debate on recognition redistribution. And it was a direct effort to say, this either or will not do. And so for me, I began with a very, at that time, and perhaps even today, controversial observation that the capacity to aspire is maldistributed, which is another way of stating what you said. It's not just that everybody has it and how do we allow it to come. It is maldistributed. And to say that, you have to be very careful not to be identified with a culture of poverty argument, poor people are limited, etc. So that whole essay was there to say that subordinated communities suffer in the distribution of the capacity to aspire, which is neither in the terms of recognition nor in the terms of redistribution, but something in between. And that is not a matter of biology or mind or mental capacity. It is a problem of experience. That they do not have an archive of experiences on which to draw the maps of how to go from here to there, wherever the there may be. So, I think, Caroline, I'm totally sympathetic to your idea that this is a different space. And the challenge becomes, if we agree that the capacity to aspire is itself maldistributed in a way that neither income nor recognition is maldistributed, those are also maldistributed, but this is an important site of maldistribution, what do we do about it? And that seems to be not a simple thing of I'll recognize you, or I'll give you a little more of my income, or I'll pay high taxes. It is building that capacity in all our interventions, whether they are mega development efforts, whether they are grassroots efforts, whether they are university efforts. How do we allow people or present poor people with the possibility of expanding or using the muscles, I usually use that metaphor, of aspiration in all our interventions in a manner that doesn't confuse that either with income distribution change or with recognition change, but something intermediate and crucial to both. So I hope, I mean, this is subject for a bigger conversation, but my intervention was precisely to say we are in a deadlock. between recognition, cultural logic, and redistribution, economic logic. I mean, this is an endless business. And how can we find a third space? And for me, aspiration was that, but aspiration cannot be seen as a level field where everybody has hopes and only some are repressed, but that hoping itself as a faculty is maldistributed. And we need to do something else. Anyway, that's a direction of the thought.
Okay, I'm not gonna entirely agree with this. There is evidence that people have not got time and resources to do planning. There is evidence that lack of resources, for example, affects cognitive ability, the ability to organize your life. I'm not sure that's the same as saying that people don't have the capacity to aspire. I think there's a question about the scale of aspiration. So my experience is that people have hope at all different levels, but they have learnt that it should be a certain size and shape. And some people have assumed that they will be Director General of the United Nations by the time they're 21, and other people have assumed it's going to be something else. So most of the work that I do with people around these questions is to do two things, is to think about the relationship between knowledge and agency. So what do we think is going to happen and how much do we know about that? That's one frame that informs how you aspire. So do we think the future is open or do we think it's closed? If we think it's closed, we've got no capacity to act. And how much do we think we have the capacity to act? So if you can get people to relocate themselves in that quadrant, if you like, to think about reframing the time scale at which you think something might be possible, or reframing the scale at which you can act, all of those things build a capacity to think that change is possible. The critical issues around the lack of resources to plan and to, if you like, get over chaotic lifestyles are nothing to do with issues of aspiration. They are fundamentally to do with issues of economic resources. There are questions about, do you have somewhere to live? Are you homeless? Do you have money? Do you have a drugs problem? I think tangling all of this up in the same thing is not necessarily that helpful. So I think we need to unpick what we mean by aspiration, which is often about thinking, how do you actually think about futures? And there's multiple ways of doing that. And then unpick the things that impact on it. I think the evidence base for it is pretty weak, to be honest. The second thing, the question about what's our strategy, I go back to the point, I think we're in a situation, I'm not sure the language of crisis or emergency is helpful. Most of us have read Naomi Klein. I mean, the production of crisis, the production of the shock doctrine is enough to kind of make you run around like a headless chicken trying to decide which particular battle to fight. I think, again, we need to return to the question of pick one thing. Pick one battle. Pick one issue that you want to work on, because the reality is other people have confidence in other people. Other people will pick other battles. So don't be running around if we're thinking about the strategy here. Do not get sucked into a language of crisis and emergency, because what that does is it makes you think, I can only do anything if I act tomorrow and immediately, and if I don't do it then it's all going to fall over. Actually reclaim the right to think slow, to think long term, and pick one thing that you're actually going to commit to.
I have profound disagreements, excellent, though lots of overlaps, but I think you're wrong on several key things. For example, that there's a choice between emergency and the long term. That's a false distinction. The world is full of real evidence-based volatilities, which have not been part of the history of mankind for 5,000 years. No, I know
it's
not.
Emergency, that's history. Change happens.
No, crisis happens. It's not, I know, look, I'm in anthropology.
Yeah, exactly.
I know about
yeah.
the discourse of crisis is produced, but there are actual crises.
There are
crises about housing, about real estate, about this, about that. It also, with the slum dwellers I work with, you have to think 20 years ahead, but that doesn't mean you're not having a demolition tomorrow. That's a crisis. It's not a theory question. It's an actual question about the pace of change and impacts on material lives. You can call it what you like. You can call it mises, rather than crisis, if you don't like it. But there are urgencies which are political and economic their nature, which impact on progress. So I disagree with the idea that it's not emergent but something else. It's not crisis but
no,
something
you need
else.
To be able to operate at both levels at the same time. And if you don't operate at both at the same time, though I'm not disagreeing that there is crisis at the moment, but if you aren't able to...
Other people you know, not I, who's lumping them? The other thing is about the conditions, that there are issues of this and issues of that. Of course there are issues of this and that and the other. People are embedded in thousands of daily problems. Who's denying that? What is then what I said that said that's not so? Help me understand and I'll clarify it. I mean, that people aren't tied up with issues of rent, crime, taxes, housing, lighting, shit, on which I've written, toilets. Are they two toilets for 800 people or three toilets for 800? These are not abstract future problems. I've written about all of those eloquently, and they're not taken off the table in stressing the need for knowledge.
Okay, so please don't meet. Okay, so apologies if I have misrepresented to you.
I don't support.
My apologies. No, I'm not trying to be antagonistic here. I suppose what I'm... No, genuinely not. Genuinely not. I wasn't... Let's be very clear. I suppose... Yes, I am. I suppose... I didn't mean this to be personal. I suppose what
it's not personal. It's argumentative.
Okay.
What's the argument? Why do you represent my argument in a certain way? It's not about me. Fine.
Okay, one second.
Sure, you're going to have many seconds.
No, I don't need many seconds. I suppose what I'm trying to say is I think it's helpful for us not to create unhelpful oppositions. So
I totally agree between crisis and the long term.
Thank you. So,
is there a popular response?
No, I suppose. I think everything that you have been raising, I think all the issues that have come up this evening are absolutely critical, and this is a really difficult area. And I think the point that you've been trying to make, that it is both economic and cultural, that the setting up of the opposition between them is not helpful, is really what I was trying to say in response to the point there. So I think if what we can try to do is, as you have said, is shift beyond those binaries and think of those things at the same time. So the point about what time scale do we work on? How do we work on tomorrow? How do we work on Monday? At the same time as trying to think ourselves out of the frames that we're operating in so that we can think longer term, trying to keep those things both in mind feel to me the challenge that we have to work through. And I'm not sure we have all the answers. I think we are working on it. And in relation to crisis, evidently, there are huge challenges and urgent issues that people are facing right now. I suppose the question I'm asking is, when I work with teachers, when I work with communities, I find it less helpful to use the language of crisis because quite often that language can paralyze. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is, how do we keep this language alive, not get stuck within it, and operate at multiple levels?
Intervention from the floor. What was the intervention from the floor?
I think it was just a misunderstanding, actually. I think, Arjun, here. I think it was just a misunderstanding. I think it was a response to what I was saying. It wasn't a representation of what you were saying. I think it was just a misunderstanding. I think Carrie was just responding to two questions from the floor.
Okay, so I think we are at the point where I have to quote Ernst Bloch. But please, would you like to...
I don't think so, no.
I
think that my response to that question would be coming from such a micro-practical level of things, you know, of affairs, that it seems to be a little bit inadequate. So I'd rather pass the mic to you.
Good. I like the a rule to live by, or a motto to live by, from the Shakers, not the Quakers, to live your life as if you will die tomorrow and will live forever. That, for me, gives you a sense of urgency without sort of being blocked to do what is in the scope of doing. That is a way to deal with this tricky issue that all problems are both too big and too small at the same time, And still we have to find a way to keep going with the perspective to infinity and tomorrow, to take the word from the title of this conference. And
that build a bridge for me.
May I?
Yeah. Because it makes it easier for me now to maybe comment a little bit on your question, Caroline, because I think from my experiences and from the people I have been dealing with and working with, first of all, I didn't talk about a pluralizing anything. You know, okay, so it was more about a hegemonical shift, basically, so a paradigmatic shift in my field. And from the people I have been working with, like these students in so-called Hauptschule, I would not say there is a lack of aspiration. There is rather, a lack of the capacity to aspire. There is rather a preoccupation that any kind of aspiration will end up in a very cynical situation or result. So working in such an environment, I think it's all about creating credibility, not tell lies, and not suggest that you know what is good for anybody. And I think in our specific context, even if it's a very old-fashioned and very corrupted concept, I would still insist that there is an urgent need for role models. And that, for example, me, 49-year-old white woman, can't provide this role model in certain contexts, you know. Sometimes I succeed, but it's very rare moments, and it's a lot of effort. And I think we need other people to come and to take on that, you know, to take on the task to become role models in these contexts. So then I think the capacity to aspire isn't such a big deal.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, very much like a down-to-earth response.
Very good definition and ending. There was one point where Carmen started in her comment to articulate her critique of the current state of affairs of the work between art institutions and schools, where she said, what is happening is either pleasant, not funny, weder angenehm, noch either pleasant, not funny. And I think it's very good that we reach this point of touching onto which is either pleasant, not funny. And that's where you start to organize hope, I think, where you get to that point. So thank you very much for following us these 3 days. Thank you very much for your passionate intervention. And if I may add a final word, thank you very much to HKW staff, to Leila, Eva, Nadia, Christina, Eva, and Maxime, and Maria, and the technicians and the translators.